Many, many, many years ago, a very wise man decided that he was going to give to his children in general, and his son in particular, some wisdom. He decided to write this down so that he would not forget it. The name of that man is Solomon, and what he wrote is called the Book of Proverbs. Now, when we think of Proverbs, we automatically think of these short, pithy statements. And granted, most of the book is that. But if you look at Proverbs carefully, you will quickly discover that the first 10 chapters, or first 9 chapters, I should say, are not these one-sentence pithy sayings, but whole paragraphs or units. That there are sort of introductory discourses in which Solomon tells his son about mainly wisdom in general, but also some particular things that he needs to know that could come under the broad umbrella of wisdom. Now, off and on, for the last year or so, we've been dipping into Proverbs. I've covered some of these passages and then done something else, and then I come back and haven't done anything in Proverbs real recently. And was just trying to decide what to do in this week, and just felt that maybe I should do one more chapter, and then I'm going to eventually make it through these 9 chapters, but I'm going to go do something else after this. But I thought that maybe particularly at this moment, we needed a little clarification in this country about the subject of sex. And lo and behold, the next chapter in Proverbs is about sex. I think this is rather interesting because in these 9 chapters, 4 times Solomon addresses the subject of immorality. He does it in chapter 2. He addresses it again in the whole of chapter 5. And he comes back to it in chapter 6. And then in his longest passage, in chapter 7, he gives an extended discourse on the subject of sex. Only this is different. On these other occasions, he's made statements. And there's been some discussion, but it's basically in the form of a statement. But when you get to chapter 7, it's not a statement, it's a story. It's a drama in which he portrays exactly what happened. And that, I think, is kind of fascinating. We could call this the story of sex, or the story behind sex, or what exactly happens when immorality takes place. This is particularly pertinent for a young person to know. But I don't think it's limited to young people or even single people. As a matter of fact, one at least of the people in this passage is married. But I think it not only has to do with the young, it has to do with the old. Because here is an older man telling his son, and maybe older people can learn from this, about how to tell their children or grandchildren about this pertinent subject. But beyond all of that, there's something else here. At the end of this passage, Solomon tells his son how to prevent this. And while the immediate context is the subject of sex, those principles apply to every area of our spiritual life. So, I would like for us to look at Proverbs chapter 7. This is a rather long passage, but it's really packed with some interesting stuff. Proverbs chapter 7, verse 1. My son, keep my words and treasure my commands within you. Keep my commands and live, and my law as the apple of your eye. Bind them on your fingers, write them on the tablets of your heart. Say to wisdom, you are my sister, and call understanding your nearest kin, that they may keep you from the immoral woman, from the seductress who flatters with her words. For at the window of my house I looked through my lattice and saw among the simple, I perceived among the youths, a young man devoid of understanding, passing along the street near her corner. He took the path to her house in the twilight in the evening, in the black and dark night. And there a woman met him with the attire of a harlot and a crafty heart. She was loud and rebellious, and her feet would not stay at home. At times she was outside, at times in the open square, lurking at every corner. So she caught him and kissed him. With an imprudent face, she said to him, "I have peace offerings with me. Today I have paid my vows. So I came out to meet you, diligently to seek your face. And I have found you. I have spread my bed with tapestry, colored coverings of Egyptian linen. I have perfumed my bed with myrrh, alloys, and cinnamon. Come, let us take our fill of love until morning. Let us delight ourselves with love, for my husband is not at home. He's gone on a long journey. He has taken a bag of money with him and will come home on the appointed day." With her enticing speech, she caused him to yield. With her flattering lips, she seduced him. Immediately he went after her as an ox goes to the slaughter, or as a fool to the correction of the stocks, till an arrow struck his liver, as a bird hastens to the stair. He did not know it would take his life. Now therefore listen to me, my children. Pay attention to the words of my mouth. Do not let your heart turn aside to her ways. Do not stray into her path. For she has cast down many wounded, and all who are slain by her were strong men. Her house is the way to hell, descending to the chambers of death. Wow. What a passage. Let me suggest that it is a story, and that it can be divided into three parts. There's a prologue, there's the drama itself, and then he ends with what could be called an epilogue. It's sort of as if this father is taking his son to a theater to watch a play. And on the way, he says, "Now, let me give you some insight into what we're about to see, and I want you to pay particular attention to it." Then they see the play, and then after it, he takes him aside, puts his arm around him, and says, "Now look, let me spell this out so that you don't do what the young man in that drama did." With that in mind, let's look at the passage. Let's begin with the prologue, which are in the first five verses. Now, much of what's here is a repetition of things he said before, so I'm not going to dwell a lot on it. This is just sort of a plea to listen, but it's more than just hear. It's hear and heed what I have to say. Verse 1 says, "My son, keep my words and treasure my commands within you." He's mentioned those kinds of things before. "Keep my commandment and live." He mentioned that in chapter 3, verse 1, and again in 4:4. "And my law is the apple of your eye." That one's new. I'll come back to it in a minute. The binding of the word has been used before in chapter 6. "Writing them on the tablets of your heart," he's referred to in chapter 3. And then he says in verse 4, "Say to wisdom, you are my sister." Now in chapter 1, he made wisdom a woman. This time he makes the woman his sister. And he says that you call understanding your nearest kin. Now, as I just pointed out, most of these little phrases have been used before. And the whole point, very simply, is I'm pleading with you. Listen to what I'm about to say. The one thing that's added is this apple of the eye business. The word apple here is really the Hebrew word for pupil. And what Solomon is saying is, you need to be sensitive to what I'm saying. And just like you would guard your eye, you need to guard this bit of wisdom I'm about to give you. Or take the little analogy of wisdom being personified as a woman, and in this case, a sister. He's saying, look, I know some brothers don't get along with their sister, but in this case, this is a sister that's near and dear. One that should be your intimate companion, your confidant. So he's saying, you ought to treat the wisdom that I'm about to give you as if it were your sister and you had an intimate relationship with her. So that's the plea with several figures of speech to drive it home. The purpose of the plea is given in verse 5, that they may keep you from the immoral woman, from the seductress who flatters with her words. The purpose of this, that you listen to me, that you listen to wisdom, in this particular case, is to keep you from immorality. Now, Solomon has made a plea that you pay attention to wisdom before. This time he takes that plea for wisdom and he focuses it like a laser on just the issue of immorality. And he says, I'm pleading with you, listen to wisdom and you'll avoid the whole pitfall of immorality. Now that's the prologue. Let's dive into the drama. Now, anytime you have a play or a story or a plot, there are characters. Well, there are three people in this play, but actually there are only two main characters. There's the father who's observing the scene, then he's introduced and immediately fades into the background, and then we have the two main characters, an inexperienced young fella and an immoral woman. Those are the two characters. Now, let's just begin by seeing who the characters are. If you were watching a good movie, the author would begin by just introducing the characters. As a matter of fact, if you watch a 30-minute drama on TV or an hour-long drama on TV, all good authors begin by just giving you a snapshot of who the people are, and then they begin to develop the plot. So all I'm going to do at this point, all Solomon does at this point, is just introduce the characters. Well, the plot will thicken in a minute. Okay? So, look at verse 6. For at the window of my house I looked through my lattice, and I saw among the simple, I perceived among the youths, a young man devoid of understanding, passing along the street near her corner. And he took the path to her house in the twilight of the evening, in the black and dark night. Now, this is an introduction of the inexperienced young man. But first he says, I was in my house looking through my lattice. Now, lattice is just exactly what it sounds like. Built the crossways, and it kept the sun and the heat out, but allowed the cool breeze to come through. So he says, you know, I was wandering by my window and I looked out, and he now sort of fades into the background and the camera turns to the inexperienced young man. So look at verse 7. He says, and I saw among the simple. Now we've met this fellow before. If you've been with me, you know we met him back in chapter 1. The Hebrew word simple means open. The idea is that this person is open to all stimuli. And consequently, he's impressionable. Now, the problem is this word carries the connotation of not only being impressionable, but being naive and gullible. Every time I've looked at this word and looked at it in its context in Proverbs, I've come to the same conclusion. This is sort of like being a junior high teenager. You think you know a whole lot, but you just hadn't had a whole lot of experience yet. So it's an inexperienced teenager. Now, that's the introduction to the first character. The second is down in verse 10. And there was a woman met him with the attire of a harlot, a crafty heart. She was loud and rebellious. Her feet would not stay at home. At times she was outside. At times she was in the open square, lurking at every corner. All right, let me introduce to you the immoral woman. It says she was dressed in the attire of a harlot. Now, this woman is not necessarily a prostitute. As we've looked at these other passages, I've pointed out, it could be, but in this case, she's married and has a house. It's probably not. All it says about her is she's dressed like a prostitute. Now, I can't help but wonder, what does that mean? I think I know what it means today, but I wonder what it meant that day. I don't have any idea, and I couldn't find anybody that would comment on that even. What I do know is this. You know, in some of the Eastern countries today, they wear long robes and veils and all this kind of stuff so that you can't lust after them. And they cover up their face, so all you can see is the woman's eyes. Years ago, I was at a conference speaking, and they had a missionary there speaking, and it was to young people. And he worked in a Muslim country where they covered the women up from head to foot, and all you could see was their eyes. That the girls had a way of dressing to alert the boys that they were flirting with them and may be available. And it had to do with, there was a standard way that they took this veil and threw it over one shoulder. If they were interested, they would throw it over the other shoulder. So you could be dressed from head to toe, apparently, and still send a signal as a harlot. So she was dressed somehow that sent a signal that she was available. All right. So it says in verse 10, she had on the attire of a harlot, but a crafty heart. This is a really interesting word. The word translated crafty, the Hebrew word, literally means guarded. And most scholars feel that it's saying she was secretive. Now, isn't this interesting? I think if she were dressed like a prostitute or harlot today, we would say she was revealing her body. But she wasn't revealing her heart. She kept that to herself. She wasn't interested in a really intimate relationship. She wasn't revealing how she felt or what she thought. She was really only interested in a superficial relationship. Very interesting indeed. It says she was loud and boisterous. I imagine she was a very outgoing gal, but she carried it even further and was loud and rebellious. Loud means boisterous, but she was also rebellious, which means stubborn. And she was constantly on the move. So she didn't stay at home, verse 11 says. But at times she was outside the house, and times she was on the open square, at times she was just constantly moving around, very outgoing, active young lady. Now, those are our two characters for the drama. This inexperienced and this immoral woman. The plot thickens. Now, let's back up and look at some of the verses that I skipped. It says in verse 8, passing along the street near her corner. Now pause. The implication of the way this is worded is this inexperienced man who lacked understanding and wisdom was just minding his own business and he happened to pass her corner. That's all. Then look at the next verse, the next phrase it says, and he took the path to her house. Now, there's a progression here. He first just passed by, perhaps innocently. Now, he is deliberately taking the path to her house. Only, he doesn't exactly know what to do. Remember, this guy's inexperienced. So, look at what it says in verse 9. In the twilight, in the evening, in the black and dark night. Now, there is clearly a progression in that verse. The twilight is just as the day ends. It's the dust, we would say. The black and dark night is clearly the middle of the night. And the evening, apparently, is that time in between. So he is describing what this young man is doing, and he's walking along, minding his own business, and this gal, he walks by for another look, and again, he's just, I didn't do anything wrong. I was just walking down the street two or three times all night. Now, that's the fella. Let me tell you what she does. As a matter of fact, what she does begins in verse 13 and goes all the way down through verse 20. If the first part of this drama is introduction of the characters, the second part could be the come on. What Solomon now does, and I find this most fascinating, is he describes the tactics of a seductress. He tells us exactly what she does to seduce him. Sounds like the Jerry Springer show or something, doesn't it? But he lays it out. And frankly, we need to know this. He mentions four things that she does. Number one, verse 10. Drop down to verse 13. And she caught him and kissed him. First thing he mentions, her first tactic was she kissed him. Now, there's a lot of words that follow. I doubt that the first thing she did was kiss him. I said it was the first thing. It's the first thing that's mentioned. Surely they had a little bit of conversation first, right? But at some point, there was a kiss. All right. Now, let me just tell you something. How many years have I been in the ministry? A lot. About 40. And you know how many times I've had this sin confessed to me? Lots. Lots, lots, lots. You know what? Let me just tell you one of the things I've learned, okay? When you get to the kiss, that ought to be the signal, this has gone too far. Okay? It's the kiss that ought to be the tip-off. Now, I suspect that there were other hints before this, like the way she was dressed, like the way she talked. We'll get to some of this in a minute. But if that didn't tip you off, because remember, this guy's inexperienced and he lacks understanding, the text says. So when you get to the kiss, that ought to be, the bells ought to be going off by that time for sure. I have rarely had anybody tell me that. I have had somebody tell me that, and they did it recently. A fellow talked to me and said that he and his wife had sort of drifted apart. She had a business and got very involved in the business, and they weren't relating, and he got friendly with a gal that he worked with, and one thing led to another, and he kissed her. Now, I don't think this fella had any intention of being unfaithful to his wife. Matter of fact, from listening to him, I'm certain of that. And you'll be convinced when I tell you that the first thing he did was go home and tell his wife he'd kissed another woman. And said, hold it. Something's bad wrong. And we got to deal with this. And the latest I heard, they were going to see a marriage counselor to see if they could put their marriage back together. Now, that's the way it ought to work. I'm just telling you, when the kiss comes, the alarm bells ought to go off. That's her first tactic. The second is flattery. Look at verse 13, but look at the latter part of it. With a imprudent face, she said to him, boy, you talk about interesting. I have a peace offering with me. Today I paid my vows. Now, she doesn't start off saying, got something in mind. She started off saying, I just came from church. Now, this is in the Old Testament. It's in a Jewish context. And their form of worship wasn't to go to a church on Sunday. They went to the tabernacle on Saturday. And they offered sacrifices there. And one of those sacrifices was something called the peace offering. And when you went through that, part of the sacrifice went to the priest, part of it was burned up, and part of it you took home, and according to the book of Leviticus, you had to eat the part that you took home that day. So she says to him, I just paid my vows, and I have some meat left over. Now that's what's going on. Let me just pause right here to say, she's about to flatter him. She starts with, you know, I went, paid my vows. But what you just need to know is that sometimes you can meet an immoral woman at church. You know? Just because they are religious doesn't mean that they aren't interested in immorality, unfortunately. But that's true. That's true. Matter of fact, a survey was taken a few years ago among singles in evangelical churches, and the number admitting to sexual immorality was mind-boggling. But it isn't among single people. I don't mean to pick on them. Married people are guilty as well, right? But just because they're religious doesn't mean that there is an immorality. Matter of fact, I understand that Louis XIV had a number of mistresses, and one of his favorite was a gal that was so religious that during Lent, she would weigh the bread to make sure she didn't break Lent. But she was his mistress. Well, that's the kind of thing going on here. Now he says, I came out to meet you, verse 15. And there's an emphasis on you, and here's where the flattery begins. I was diligent to seek your face. Now, he's been walking up and down, and apparently she knows. And she said, you know what? I have this meat left over. I'm preparing dinner, and I need to have somebody to help me eat it. And I picked out you. You are the one person I would like to have come eat with me. So she is flattering him. That's exactly what's going on. And if there's any doubt in your mind about it, back up to verse 5. From the seductress who flatters with her words. It says that she is using flattery. And later in the passage, it says the same thing. Verse 21. With her enticing speech, she caused him to yield. With her flattering lips, she seduced him. Now, we need to make a little distinction here. It's perfectly legitimate to compliment somebody. But when that compliment gets excessive, then it's flattery. When it's unnecessary to go that far, it's flattery. I think that in this case, she's using flattery to make him feel special to her. I went looking just for you. Now, I think there's a fine line here. It's perfectly legitimate for a man to say to a woman, or a woman to say to a man, you know, you're a really special person. You have great abilities or gifts or whatever, and God's given them to you, and God bless you. But what's going on here is the use of flattery to say, and you are very, very special to me, with sexual overtones. That is what is happening. So she's using flattery to seduce him, and the text calls it just that. The third thing she does, first is she kissed him, the second is she uses flattery, the third thing is she became very sensuous, or she used sensuous speech. Look at verse 16. I have spread my bed with tapestry, colored coverings of Egyptian linen. I have perfumed my bed with myrrh, alloys, and cinnamon. Come, let us take our fill with love until the morning. Let us delight ourselves with love. She's saying, now she started out talking about the dining room. Now we're to the bedroom. Let me show you my bedroom. I mean, just look at this. I mean, look at the tapestry. It was pleasant to the eye. What is described here is soft and inviting. And then she's appealing to all the senses. And she'd lit candles, and there were, you know, scents going out through the room. You walked in this thing and thought, wow, does that look inviting? Exactly what's going on. By the way, I don't want to be too dogmatic about this, but I'd like to pause long enough to point out something. Who wears perfume? Men or women? Mostly women. Mostly. I said I didn't want to be too dogmatic about this. Now, why would you imagine a woman wears perfume? Does perfume appeal to women? We associate it with women. Or do women wear perfume to appeal to... Just think about that, all right? I don't want to be too dogmatic about it. But, and I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm just saying, is it possible that there is an appeal through the nose? You know? So we talk about the way to get to a man's heart is through his stomach. Maybe it's through the nose. Yeah, just think about it. All right, there's a fourth thing she did, and that is she gave him reassurance. Now put yourself in the scene. If you're a young, inexperienced man having this come on by a woman, and you know she's married, what's the number one thing in your head right now? Whoa, what if he comes home? So she's now got to reassure him that it is safe. And he'll not come home till the appointed day. Now all of this is designed to say, look, he took so much money. He has so many plans. There is no way he's coming back tonight. So what we would like for you to know is that it's okay. It's safe. Now, by the way, be careful. I remember a few years ago when a rather famous televangelist was caught with a prostitute. And I went to a friend of mine who's a nationally known psychologist, Christian psychologist, and I said to him, why in the world did he do that? He was caught once. This is the second time. Why would he do it twice? Now, what I was after was some profound psychological insight. I mean, this guy I'm talking to is the head of a whole graduate school of psychology. So I said, Bruce, why did he do that? And he looked at me and he said, because he thought he wouldn't get caught. You know what? There's some profound truth to that. That part of the seduction is that you're not going to get caught. Why, if you don't tell and I don't tell, nobody will know. Right? Nobody's going to see us. Nobody's going to hear about it. So don't worry about it. Then it's safe. So part of the seduction is being convinced that it's okay and it's safe and you're not going to get caught. Remember the old proverb, character is what you do when nobody's looking. So these are the four tactics of the seductress. She uses flattery. She kisses him. She uses sensuality. And in this case, it's her bed. It could have been other things. And she uses reassurance. In studying this passage, I went to talk to somebody and said, you know, give me some insight into this. And I was... telling my wife what was in this passage, and she said, oh, I know a case that's just exactly like that. Now, she doesn't know the woman, but knows the woman. And this woman went to have her picture taken by a photographer. And she took one look at him and she said, I'm going after him. And she told her girlfriend that, my wife's friend. And she then had to go for a series of sittings, and sure enough, she seduced him. I said, what did she do? And she said, everything you just said. So this was written when? How many thousands of years ago? And it's still pertinent today. All right, that's the drama. An inexperienced man, young man, was seduced by an immoral woman with a kiss and flattery and sensuality and reassurance. Now the play is over. The curtain comes down and Solomon and his son start to leave. And Solomon puts his arm around his son and says, in essence, now son, You don't ever want to do that. And that's the epilogue. He says, with enticing words, we read verse 21. Pick up verse 22. Immediately he went after her as an ox goes to the slaughter, as the fool to the correction of the stocks, till an arrow struck his liver, as the bird hastens to the stair. He did not know it would take his knife. Now therefore, listen to me, my children. Pay attention to the words of my mouth. Do not let your heart turn aside to her ways. Do not stray into her path, for she has cast down many wounded, and all who are slain by her were strong men. Now, let me just summarize what are in these latter verses. It seems to me that Solomon is giving his son three suggestions for how to avoid immorality. Number one, guard your heart. Verse 25, do not let your heart turn aside to her ways. Now, not only this sin, but all sin. The number one thing you need to do is guard your heart. Jesus said, it's not what enters the man that defiles him, it's what comes out. Solomon says in chapter 4, guard your heart, for out of it are the issues of life. If you don't hear anything else I say today, hear this, guard your heart. Spiritually, it's the finest piece of advice I can give to you. When you find yourself drifting away, guard your heart. When you find yourself slipping into a bad attitude, guard your heart. When you find yourself being tempted to immorality, guard your heart. It starts in the head. Years ago, when I first moved to Southern California, I had a luncheon appointment with a man that had pastored the church I had come to pastor years before. His name was J. Vernon McGee. And I had a luncheon appointment with him at his office at Through the Bible in Pasadena. I got there a little early, and I didn't realize he wasn't there yet. But as I pulled into the parking lot, I saw his parking space. He wasn't there yet, so I could see the sign that was in front of it. Had a little sign that said, I'll never forget this, in McGee fashion, it said, "Don't even think about parking here." Now, let me make a suggestion. That sign is what you need to post right inside your skull so your brain can see it and your heart can remember it. Don't even think about doing this, because that's where it starts. Now, there's a second piece of advice. Verse 25, do not stray into her paths. Now, we can blame her because she seems to be the aggressor. But was he totally innocent? Not on your life. How do you know that? Because the text plainly says he just happened to pass by. Then he chose to go by. Then he did it at the twilight. Then he did it in the evening. Then he did it in the dark of the night. This man's not innocent. He's looking for trouble. Now Solomon says, son, let me give you a piece of advice. Don't go down that path. Don't go there. Don't do that. I think if the Bible has any solution to sexual immorality or sexual temptation, it is this. I'm going to make this as simple as I possibly can, all right? I don't want you to miss this. You ready? I'm going to give it to you in the Greek and the Hebrew. You ready? Flee!
Yeah. That's right.
Literal translation. In 1 Corinthians, Paul says, flee immorality. In 2 Timothy, Paul says to Timothy, flee youthful lust. Flee. Flee. Just get out of there. Don't go there. The minute you sense that she is an immoral woman, has designs on you, and that was abundantly clear in this passage, it's time to move on. Mm-hmm. It's time to keep going. Yep. Move on. Mm-hmm. Get out of there. Yeah. Flee. A classic illustration is Joseph. He got out of there so fast, he lost his coat. Leave the coat. Get out of there. Now there's a third suggestion. And it's the rest of these verses we haven't looked at. In verse 26, he says, "For," and as I pointed out, the word "for" means I'm about to explain to you what I just said. So in a sense, this could be an explanation of don't go anywhere near her. On the other hand, it could also be a third piece of advice about how to prevent this. He says, "For she has cast down many wounded, and all who are slain by her were strong men. Her house is the way to hell, descending to the chamber of death." I would say the third bit of advice is consider the consequences. Look, folks, this is leading to trouble. Any way you cut it. In the words of Proverbs, it's leading to death and hell. Now, hell in the book of Proverbs is Sheol, which is the grave. And as I've pointed out, as we've moved through Proverbs, life in the book of Proverbs is life at its fullest, and death isn't necessarily physical death. Notice hell comes before death in this last verse. But rather, it's living life less than at its fullest. The word death really just means separation. It separates you from God. It separates you from other people. It separates you from yourself. It separates you from your honor and your integrity. It separates you. It's death. So consider the consequences. Now in this regard, let me point out some things. This man was unaware of what was happening. Just plain dumb. Look at back up at verse 22. It says, "Immediately he went in after her." And that implies that he was in a state of indecision and he impulsively did it. But notice what Solomon says. "As an ox goes to the slaughter," ox isn't aware that he's going to be killed. "As a fool to the correction of the stocks until the arrow strikes his liver." A criminal is headed to the stocks or jail, and it doesn't hit him how serious it is until he gets put in the jail and they slam the door and turn the key. And then it's like an arrow to his liver. It hits him. He was unaware of what he was doing or the full extent of it. Or verse 23 says, "As the bird hastens to the snare, he did not know it would take his life." And then he comes back at verse 27 and says, "Descending to the chambers of death." You see, this inexperienced young man, and for that matter, this experienced older man sometimes, just isn't aware of what's going on. They are not aware of how serious it is. They focus on the cup of pleasure, not realizing they're drinking an ocean of trouble. They think of the night of pleasure, not aware of the days and months and years of torment. Now let me tell you what every man thinks that falls into this pit. Not me. You know, not me. The biblical response to that is, "Take heed when you think you stand, lest you fall." Now I want you to notice what this passage says. Verse 26. "For she's cast down many wounded, and all who were slain by her were strong men." Folks, let me tell you something. This isn't just weak people who do this. People who think they are strong and who are in areas fall to this sin. Just remember David. Remember Samson. Remember Solomon, who wrote this. And if there's any doubt left in your mind, ask Bill Clinton. I'm telling you, this is a particularly grievous sin that causes death and destruction. So Solomon says, "Son, remember this play, remember this drama, remember how it happened. guard your heart. And when you hear those flattering words, guard your heart. And when you see that sensuous action, guard your heart. And if it ever gets to a kiss, run! If you have any doubts, just consider the consequences, because they are awesome. So an inexperienced young man was seduced by an immoral woman with a kiss, with flattery, with sensuous behavior, and reassurance that it's going to be okay. But it isn't. You get caught. And it leads to death. You know, I think that we hear this and we think, I think this generation hears this and they think, why are you being so hard? Why isn't this kind of restrictive? You know? Aren't you putting too many limits on us? I mean, didn't we go through the sexual revolution a few years ago? Yeah, we did, and that's our problem. I recommend you become a conscientious objector in the sexual revolution.
Amen. Yes.
But let me tell you something. From a biblical point of view, this is not restriction. God has said, I designed sex and I put it in marriage. And it ought to be there. And the man who violated that principle more than any other, Solomon, had 300 wives and 700 concubines, writes more on this subject, more extensively on this subject, than anybody else in the Bible. The man who had great wisdom in a lot of areas said, in essence, I learned the hard way, son. Listen to me. This isn't a restriction. When you break this rule, you will do it to your own death and destruction. Learn the parable of the kite. A young boy tied a string to a kite. Trailing it behind him, he ran face into the wind. And the kite took flight and soared higher and higher and higher until all the string was let out. And then the kite began to object. You're holding me down. I want my freedom. I could soar higher. I could obtain greater heights if it weren't for that string. So the kite did what this passage says the woman was, rebellious. And it tugged and it tugged and it tugged until the string broke. And for a moment it looked like the kite would soar even higher, but momentarily it took a nosedive and plunged to the earth and was totally destroyed. You see, that string that you thought was holding you back was really keeping you up. God knows that and says, hear me, please hear me. This one is particularly dangerous. Look out. If there is anything we ought to learn from what's happening, and anything we ought to learn from what God says, it's, my son, be wise. Avoid this one. Father, we want to be faithful to you. We confess and acknowledge that sometimes we have fickle hearts and we wander away. So help us to guard our heart. Protect our lives so that we can walk with you and honor you with our lives. Lord, I pray that you would speak to us about this today. In Jesus' name, amen.